Good evening. This is our third series of lessons on Jewish history and culture. Our first lesson was about a month ago, I think, on Josephus. And then last week we had a study of the Dead Sea Scrolls, part one. And tonight we're going to have part two of our look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. By looking both at Josephus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, we are looking at perhaps the two primary non-biblical sources that we have of Jewish history and culture. Certainly, there's we'll talk about the Talmud and some other sources also, but those two are certainly up at the top of the list. Last week, was part one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So if you weren't here last week, you're kind of coming in on the middle. But if you'd like to hear last week's lesson, I do have that on audio. I can get that to you. Last week, we started off by asking the question, why should we even study the Dead Sea Scrolls? And we talked about a number of reasons for doing that. I think all very good reasons for that. We also looked last week at the discovery of the scrolls. How did this come to be? This has been described correctly as either the greatest, or certainly one of the greatest, archaeological discoveries of all time. And there was an interesting story about how it was found. We talked about the condition of the scrolls and the fact that most of the damage to the scrolls happened after they were found, and not during the 2,000 years in which they were in the cave. We talked about the Essenes, who most people believe is the group that produced the scrolls, that copied the manuscripts, that created the scrolls, and then stored the scrolls, hid the scrolls in the caves when the Romans were coming down on them in AD 68. And finally, last week, we talked a little bit about some of the biblical scrolls and the caves in which they were found. And tonight, I want to start off by looking at the sectarian scrolls, which are the non-biblical scrolls, just various books that the Essenes had either written themselves in some cases or copied and had been written by others in other cases. And they certainly were not treated as scripture by the Essenes. The Essenes knew the difference between scripture and non-scripture, but these sectarian scrolls were just found in the caves among the biblical manuscripts. Why study the sectarian scrolls? I mean, I guess we should ask that question as we started last week with a similar question for the scrolls in general. Why should we look at these scrolls? Well, for students of history and students of language, these scrolls are just invaluable in understanding the biblical times, understanding some of the language in the Bible and how various words are used. When there's an obscure word in Hebrew, for example, how do we determine what it means? And the best way to determine what it means is in the context. Certainly in Scripture we can determine from the context. But if we see that word used elsewhere, we can also use that context to help us determine its meaning. And we get some of that from the sectarian scrolls. Let me start off by saying, despite some wild claims you may see in the press, nothing revolutionary has been found in any of these sectarian scrolls. So there's no real conspiracy theory that has any validity with regard to what these scrolls showed. But we've gained a much greater understanding through these sectarian scrolls of the Jewish history between the Testaments. We looked at some of that history when we studied Daniel, because Daniel, of course, laid out a map of history between the Testaments in chapter 11. And we looked at some of that history, and we see some of that history as we read the sectarian scrolls. And we also, as I say, though, we see the vocabulary, we see the grammar. There's just a tremendous amount of knowledge that we've learned from the sectarian scrolls. One of the best known is called the Manual of Discipline. The Manual of Discipline. That was found in cave number one, which you recall, except for cave number four, was the had the most manuscripts in cave number one. And it seems to have been the book of rules, the book of the principles that governed the Essenes. This was kind of their, as it says, the manual of discipline. How to be a good Essene? Well, they would read this manual of discipline. So that scroll there, I think there were several copies of that, and that certainly was something that they relied on a lot. A very unusual text that was found among the sectarian scrolls was a series of encoded horoscopes. Now, you really wouldn't think of the Jews as having horoscopes, because they were told repeatedly not to worship the sun and the stars, but they did. They had horoscopes in one of these caves, and apparently they knew it was something they probably shouldn't have. They wrote it in a secret alphabet, and they used mirror writing. Have you ever seen Leonardo da Vinci, where he'll write and it looks like you're looking at it in a mirror? He was able to write backwards like that. They did that with this horoscope book. Very, very unusual in many ways. But that was among the sectarian scrolls. One of the scrolls described the community as the congregation of men dedicated to the perfection of holiness. It described themselves as the true Israel and all others as the false Israel. They described themselves as those who had entered into the new covenant. They called themselves the sons of light. They called themselves the sons of righteousness. They called themselves the sons of truth. Those outside were called the sons of darkness and the sons of perversion. We see all of this. This tells us so much about the Essenes themselves. Now, these Essenes were convinced that the Greek-Roman society of their day was corrupt. And for the most part, they were right. It was corrupt. But they were also convinced, the Essenes were, that the Jews who had made their peace with Rome were apostate. So that's one reason they were out in the wilderness, that they didn't want anything to do with Rome, had nothing to do with it. And that's one reason they were out there. They also felt they'd gone out in the wilderness to prepare the way of the Lord. And again, you can hear the Old Testament prophecies coming through. They were applying that to themselves, and they thought they were doing that through their rigorous discipline. How did this group get started? From some of the scrolls, we kind of get a hint that they had been priests that were expelled from the temple. They were tossed out, and there may have been even a former high priest among their number. There is someone called the righteous teacher that's mentioned in the scrolls, and that may have been the leader of this group that got expelled from the temple. Now, one of the most controversial aspects of the Dead Sea Scrolls involves its relationship, if any, with Christianity, particularly some of these sectarian scrolls. One author has even incorrectly described Christianity as Essenism that succeeded on a big scale. That's total nonsense. But you can see that there is a controversy with regard to the relationship between the Essenes and Christianity. We've already seen last week how the Essenes had great love for each other. We've already seen that they tried to live simple and virtuous lives. We've already seen how they held all things in common. So, I mean, on the surface, you can see some similarities with Christians. In fact, some people look at the New Testament and they say Paul may have been borrowing language from the Dead Sea Scrolls in 2 Corinthians 6, 14 through 15. That's where Paul talks about contrasting righteousness and lawlessness, light and dark, Christ and Belial. In fact, that last one, they say, is the most striking example because that was a popular Jewish demon, we're told, that's frequently mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In fact, Paul uses six words in those two verses that don't appear anywhere else in his writing, and they do appear in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's possible that Paul borrowed some terms from the Essenes and from the Dead Sea Scrolls. We know Paul was very well educated, and he certainly could have had those in his vocabulary, but I don't think that proves anything with regard to the relationship between the Essenes and Christianity. And although there are some surface similarities, there are major and irreconcilable differences between the Essenes and Christians. The Essenes were a closed and a secret society. In fact, we can't even be sure of the name of any Essene based upon their writings. So we don't even really know their names. Very closed, very secretive. While Jesus, of course, stressed love, the Essenes stressed hatred. That's really the only word for it. Jesus' attitude toward the Romans was in stark contrast to the Essenes' attitude toward the Romans. In fact, in Matthew 5:43, Jesus said, "You've heard it been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy." He may have been referring to the Essenes there, because that is certainly what they said, to hate their enemy. And Jesus knew what was ahead for these Roman-hating Jews. He was going to tell them in Matthew 24 what was ahead for them. So I think he was looking down the road and saw that where the Essenes were headed was not a good spot. The Essenes were ascetic. They regarded all pleasure as evil. The Essenes were sticklers for ritual purification, in contrast to Jesus, who of course said it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out that defiles him, Matthew 15:11. One scholar said that statement alone was an irreconcilable difference between Jesus and the Essenes. The Essenes did not go to the temple. They offered no sacrifices. Jesus, of course, went to the temple. He told the lepers he had cleansed to go to the temple and offer a sacrifice, Matthew 8, verse 4. The Essenes denied the resurrection of the body. Jesus associated with outcasts, with lepers, with women, with children. He even visited the house of a leper. The Essenes would never have done any of that. So there are major, major differences. So anyone who tries to tell you that the Essenes are linked with Christians somehow, no. Well, why then is Jesus linked by some with the Essenes? Well, I think the main argument is one from silence. Jesus did not condemn the Essenes, at least not by name, by the name Essenes, like he did the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We don't see the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. We just see the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So some people look at that and say, well, Jesus must have liked the Essenes. I mean, talk about a leap of logic, right? I mean, how does that follow? Whoever you don't mention, you must love and appreciate and join. I mean, where does that come from? If the Essenes aren't mentioned, because in a moment we're going to talk about the fact they may very well be mentioned in the Bible. If they weren't mentioned in the Bible, how could we explain that? Well, as I said, they were separate. They were separated. They were out in the wilderness. They were a small group. The Talmud doesn't mention the Essenes. There are a lot of sources that don't mention the Essenes. So that argument from silence doesn't really settle anything. But I think a better question for us is this. Was Jesus really silent about the Essenes? Now, certainly the word Essene doesn't appear in the New Testament, but did Jesus really have nothing to say about the Essenes? Some say that when Jesus says in Matthew 24, so if they say to you, look, he's in the desert, don't go out. Some people are saying, well, that may be an indirect allusion to the Essenes. They were certainly out in the desert, and they certainly thought they were preparing the way. But Mark 8, 14 through 21 may be a better one. In Mark 8, 14 through 21, Jesus told his disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of the Herodians. Well, the disciples were concerned about their lack of bread, and Jesus reminded them that when he fed 5,000, there were 12 baskets left over, and when he fed 4,000, there were 7 baskets left over. Those were, of course, literal baskets, a literal 12 baskets and a literal 7 baskets. But sometimes when we have literal numbers in the Bible, they're also chosen by God for their figurative meaning. We saw that in Daniel with 70. It was a literal 70 years, but it also had a figurative meaning. If these literal 12 baskets and these literal 7 baskets had a figurative meaning, what might it be? Well, with the Pharisees, they ate 12 loaves of the presence. Talked about Leviticus 24, and they made a big showing of that. And so he may have been referring to the 12 loaves to the Pharisees. Well, what about the 7 loaves? Well, the Essenes ate 7 loaves during their 7-day feast known as the Day of Ordination of the Priest. So perhaps he's referring to the Essenes and the Pharisees with the 12 and the 7. But where are the Essenes mentioned anywhere in this account, you ask, in Mark chapter 8? Well, look at Mark chapter 8, verse 15. What is the leaven of Herod, or better translated, the leaven of the Herodians? Who are the Herodians? That may have been the Essenes. Josephus tells us that Herod was a protector of the Essenes, and that he showed special kindness to the Essenes. That's what Josephus tells us. And if so, they may have been known as the Herodians. And if so, that means Jesus' message here may have been, don't concern yourself with the Pharisees and with the Essenes, because I can do so much more. They have 7 loaves or 12 loaves. I have 7 baskets. I have 12 baskets. That may have been the message of Mark chapter 8, if in fact the Herodians does refer to the Essenes. Another reference may be in Matthew chapter 12, Matthew chapter 12, verses 11 and 12. We know the Essenes were thoroughgoing legalists. I mean, they took legalism to a new level. Josephus said they were more scrupulous than any other Jew regarding the Sabbath. Any other Jew, we know what the Pharisees thought of the Sabbath. The Essenes were worse than the Pharisees in that regard. In Matthew 12, before he heals a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath, Jesus has a debate, apparently with some Pharisees, and he asks whether it's lawful to heal on the Sabbath. And he said unto them, What man shall there be among you that shall have one sheep? And if it fall into a pit on the Sabbath day, will he not lay hold on it and lift it out? How much then is a man better than a sheep? Wherefore it is lawful to do well on the Sabbath days. And then we're told in Matthew 12:14, the Pharisees made plans to destroy him. Well, one of the scrolls, the sectarian scrolls, called the Damascus document, says the following. No caregiver should carry a baby on the Sabbath, either going out or coming in. No one should help an animal give birth on the Sabbath. If it falls into a well or a pit, he may not lift it out on the Sabbath. Any living human who falls into a body of water or a cistern shall not be helped out with a ladder, a rope, or any other instrument on the Sabbath. That's the Essenes' view of the Sabbath. Okay, but how is Matthew chapter 12 linked to the Essenes? All we saw in Matthew chapter 12 were the Pharisees. Well, Mark also tells us about that event. And in Mark chapter 3, verse 6, we see the Pharisees consulted with guess who? The Herodians, on how to destroy Jesus. And the Pharisees went forth and straightway took counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. Again, I think there's a really good case those Herodians are the Essenes. And we certainly saw their view of the Sabbath, which was diametrically opposed to the view of the Lord of the Sabbath. Now, some might argue, well, the Pharisees and the Essenes were arch enemies, so they never would have gotten together to do anything. Well, they were arch enemies, but perhaps they were in complete agreement about one thing, their hatred of Jesus. And that may have brought them together. We certainly saw that with Herod and Pilate, didn't we? One of the more famous scrolls was the War Scroll. The full title of that scroll is The War Between the Children of Light and the Children of Darkness. And it's a blend of Old Testament history and a Roman military manual. It's kind of an odd mix, but an interesting scroll. But what I want to focus on is the full title, The Children of Light and the Children of Darkness. They called themselves the Children of Light, the Essenes did, the Children of Light. The temple in Jerusalem, they said, though, is in the hands of the Children of Darkness. And they sought to separate themselves from them. Recall that Jesus sometimes talked about the Children of Light. He did so in Luke 16, verse 8. He did so in John 12, verse 36. The passage from John tells us that Christians are the true children of light. But the passage from Luke chapter 16, I think, is particularly interesting here. Luke chapter 16, verse 8, is in the middle of the parable of the unjust steward, which I think is certainly the most difficult parable to understand. The parable of the unjust steward in the New Testament. And in that difficult parable, Jesus refers to the sons of light, in a way that seems unusual, which is one of the reasons the parable is difficult. Jesus says the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. Well, most think that Jesus was referring there to his own followers, and that very well may be the case. And certainly there's various explanations for the parable that make perfect sense if that is in fact what's going on here. But some have proposed that in that parable, when Jesus says the children of light, he's referring instead to the Essenes, who called themselves the children of light. And in fact, the phrase the wealth of unrighteousness or the mammon of unrighteousness in verse 9, that's also an Essene phrase found frequently in the Dead Sea Scrolls. If, in fact, Jesus is referring there to the Essenes in this parable, well, what's the point of the parable then? Well, the Essenes, again, refer to themselves as the children of light. They referred to those outside their community as the children of darkness. They referred to anything outside the community as the mammon of unrighteousness. They were separatists. They were completely separate from the world. They held their money among themselves. They didn't give it to anyone. They hated people outside. So they were completely exclusive. They were separate. They held on to their money. They didn't help others. Jesus may have been making the point that people come before money, that no one who's a separatist like that is ever going to reach anyone with the gospel. They're never going to do good for anybody. And that may have been the point of that parable. It's just an interesting way to look at it. I'm not saying it's definitely the meaning of the parable, but what I'm saying is that we would not have even known that was a possibility if it hadn't been for the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the vocabulary and the language and the sectarian scrolls has put that on the table as a possible understanding of that very difficult parable. So I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. I'm not convinced that's what's going on in the parable, but I am convinced it's something we should look at and consider because it's a possible understanding of it. And certainly some of the language in the parable is copied or is found in some of the sectarian scrolls. What about John the Baptist? Was John an Essene? You do hear that sometimes. He did preach in the wilderness. He was ascetic, but of course he also had many differences with the Essenes. Let's start with the similarities first. Similarities. Matthew 11, verse 18 tells us that John did not come eating and drinking. In fact, we're told he ate locusts and wild honey, food found out in the wilderness, out in the desert. He was the voice of one crying in the wilderness, preparing the way for the Lord. We've already seen the Essenes thought that's what they were doing. John sought to be independent of the Jewish authorities. He lived outside the community. So again, some similarities there. John's disciples were known to fast. They were known to recite special prayers. The Essenes did both of those things. John referred in Matthew 3, verse 7, to the hypocrites who came to him as a brood of vipers, literally creatures of the snake or sons of the devil. That phrase occurs repeatedly in the Dead Sea Scrolls. John preached in the wilderness. That, of course, is where Qumran is located. Luke 1, verse 80 ends with a remarkable statement about John's birth. And the child grew and became strong in the spirit, and he was in the wilderness till the day of his manifestation to Israel. How could this child, the only son of aged parents, grow up in the wilderness? He may have lived with the Essenes. It's a possibility. It's a possibility. Josephus tells us the Essenes would receive children of other people while they were still young and capable of instruction, and then they would raise them in the Essene community. We have no way of knowing that that's true. But if so, that might explain some of the similarities we just saw. But although there are similarities, there are major differences between John and the Essenes. So even if he was raised with the Essenes, he was not an Essene when he began his ministry. He left that group if he was ever with that group. As we've said, the Essenes were an exclusive group, and they never evangelized. Judaism as a whole had little missionary zeal. The Essenes had zero missionary zeal. John, of course, was very concerned for people, and he went out preaching a message to all, very different from the Essenes. The Essenes ceremonial washing, it was reserved for those who were already fully initiated, and it was repeated often. Again, very different from John's baptism. John is never called an Essene, not in the Bible certainly, but also not outside the Bible. Josephus refers to John, does not call him an Essene. Josephus does identify other people as being Essenes, but not John. And Jesus, in fact, said, of those born of women, there has not arisen one greater than John, Matthew 11, verse 11. But if we're correct with what we said earlier, Jesus was very critical of the Essenes. So again, John was not an Essene. Also, John was an outspoken critic of the government, and he even criticized whom? Herod. Herod. So the Essenes would never have criticized Herod, as we've seen. He was their special benefactor. Well, how do we explain the similarities and the differences? Well, as I say, perhaps John was raised by the Essenes. Possible. But if so, he left early, and certainly left when he began his ministry. It's also quite possible, in fact, perhaps even more likely, that John had no connection with the Essenes at all, and that any similarity is just due to the fact that they were both influenced by the Old Testament scriptures. You know, the supposed connections between Christianity and the Essenes, they're all very, very tenuous, and in fact, they fall apart as soon as you start looking at the facts. The Essenes and certainly existed at the time of Christ. They were around up until AD 68. But the scrolls don't mention Jesus. They don't mention any followers of Jesus. They were separate, and there does not really seem to be any connection there. One final thing about the Dead Sea Scrolls. You may be interested in kind of continuing your study of the Dead Sea Scrolls and looking into those. There are a couple of books, I think, that are particularly good. One is called The Dead Sea Scrolls in English. And I believe that book just gives the sectarian a translation of the sectarian documents that have been found. There's another, a companion volume called the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible, which pieces together the fragments and again translates them into English. It's an interesting read because you'll be reading along and suddenly there'll be three or four chapters that are just missing. Well, it's not that someone has taken a penknife to the Bible as happened in the Old Testament. It's that those sections were not found among the scrolls. So the only thing we have in the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible are the scrolls that were actually found. So, for example, you won't find Esther in that Bible because Esther was not found. But you will find fragments, at least, of every other Old Testament book. And this gives a translation of them, along with footnotes and interesting study of it. If you have a computerized Bible through Logos, which is a very popular source of that, they have both of those in electronic format you can download, as well as a lot of other books in the Dead Sea Scrolls in both the original languages and in English. And they also have an entire video series of like 12 or more lessons that goes through and describes the Dead Sea Scrolls and teaches you how to use the resources and study it. So there's a lot more to look at on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but fascinating, and certainly the greatest archaeological discovery of all time in my estimation and that of others. And we can learn a great deal about New Testament times and about the Jews from that study. First, any questions on Dead Sea Scrolls? All right, our next topic, which we'll get to a little bit tonight, I want to look at are the Feast of Israel. The Feast of Israel. What I'd like to do next is walk through each of the feasts of Israel that we read about in the Old Testament and talk about how they came to be, what they meant at the time, and I also want to show how every single feast in the Old Testament has a bright neon flashing arrow pointing straight toward Jesus. They're all pointing us toward Christ. And it's a beautiful thing to study when you look back and look at Jewish history and the feast and what they were doing and how it's all was pointing toward Christ. A beautiful thing. You know, you might wonder today, well, you know, they had all these feasts and all these holidays and all this stuff. You know, why don't we have that today? Why is it that as Christians, the only day we celebrate like that is the Lord's Day? And we do it every week. We don't have Christmas and we don't have Easter. We have the Lord's Day every week. Why is that? Why is it that we don't have all these holidays? And the answer is that we don't need them anymore. They were all pointing toward Christ and we now have Christ. So the only holiday we ever celebrate, never should celebrate, is the day of the Lord, the first day of the week, and that is our holiday. And we don't need these other holidays because we have the reality in Christ now after the cross. The first one I'd like to talk about is the Sabbath. We've already mentioned a little bit about the Sabbath tonight, and particularly how it had been twisted by so many at that time. And particularly, you know, the Pharisees we know, but also, as I say, the Essenes. The Essenes were the real sticklers for the Sabbath. You couldn't even get your baby out of the well if you were an Essene, which may have explained why they didn't have too many Essenes at the time. The Sabbath and circumcision. Sabbath and circumcision are the two distinguishing traits of Judaism. And no man could ever be thought to be a truly religious Jew if they failed to observe either of those things. That's how important it was. Sabbath means rest, as we know, and it was given by God to the Israelites through Moses on Mount Sinai. It's a God-appointed day of rest and of worship. In Exodus 31, 12 through 17, the Lord said to Moses, "Say to the people of Israel, you shall keep my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. You shall keep the Sabbath, because it is holy for you. Everyone who profanes it shall be put to death. Whoever does any work on it, that soul shall be cut off from among his people. 6 days shall work be done, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall be put to death. Therefore the people of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." Beautiful, beautiful. And when you look at the warnings in there, you get some idea of perhaps why the Pharisees and the Essenes were so concerned about it, because the warnings were pretty dire. One other thing I notice when I read that is that final verse: in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested. And it's talking about what? The Sabbath day. Anyone who tells you those days weren't 24-hour days, you ought to take them right here. Right here. The same word. The same word. Same word. Those were 24-hour days. Now the Talmud, which was, of course, not part of the Bible, but kind of the Jewish commentary, if you think of it that way, on the Bible, it had an entire section devoted just to the Sabbath and how it was to be observed. There were 39 categories of activities that must not be performed on the Sabbath. And those categories were subdivided into 39 classes, making a total of 39 squared, or 1,521 Sabbath rules in the Talmud. So they had taken that one little verse, you shall not work on the Sabbath, and they had made 1,521 rules on what was not to be done on the Sabbath. For example, how far may a man walk on the Sabbath? What may he carry on the Sabbath day without breaking the law of not bearing a burden? May he carry a handkerchief? No, if in his pocket. Yes, if tied around his neck. Is an egg laid on the Sabbath day fit for consumption? They had arguments over that, and they were split. The Sabbath began at sunset on Friday evening, and there was a service in the synagogue that consisted of special prayers of welcome for the Sabbath, which was called the bride, or the queen, as it would come. When the family returned from the synagogue, they would then partake of a cup of wine called the kiddush, which meant sanctification. And then after supper, they would have prayers and hymns that they chanted. One Jewish scholar said, even more than the Jews have kept the Sabbath, has the Sabbath kept the Jews? That was an interesting way of looking at it. That the Sabbath, in many ways, kept the Jews more than the Jews kept the Sabbath. It was something that preserved their identity and in some ways kind of maintained their life as the Jewish people. In one remarkable exception, however, the Sabbath allowed Jerusalem to be conquered by Pompey, the Roman. And we saw that in Josephus, in fact, that Pompey took advantage of the fact that the Jews would not lift up weapons and things on the Sabbath, and he used that against them. But in most cases, the Sabbath did keep the Jews together as a people. And, you know, again, when you look at these feasts, you wonder, well, why did they have them all? So much of the Old Covenant and the laws in the Old Covenant had to do with one thing, and that was to keep the Jewish nation, the remnant, going, because they had to be here in the first century when Christ came. And in fact, as we saw in Daniel, more than that, the temple had to be here in the first century when Christ came. There had been prophecies about that. It had to be here. So we saw that happening in Ezra. We saw that happening if you looked in Nehemiah, also there, we saw that coming. We saw everything coming together so that in the fullness of time, at the perfect time, Jesus was born in that manger. And nothing was left to chance. If Daniel chapter 11 teaches us anything, it is that nothing was left to chance. God made sure it was going to happen exactly as he said it was going to happen. And no detail was too small. The Romans were there. Peace was in the land. The Greeks had been defeated, just as Daniel had prophesied. And again, we saw that the temple was there in the first century before it was destroyed by the Romans. Most importantly, the Jewish people were there. So that there in the land of Israel, God could find Mary and Joseph and the other faithful Jews who were waiting the coming Messiah and bring Jesus into the world to bless us and bless the entire world as he had promised Abraham so long ago. And we see that in the feast, don't we? Next week, we'll start by looking at the Passover and then continue on through the other feasts of Israel. Thank you very much for your attention. Let's stand for our closing prayer.